Good afternoon, everyone. We are here to talk about the future of the future. I'd like to introduce, for those of you who haven't already been to an introduction, Richard Morgan, our international guest of honour, and Teresa, our professional WA guest of honour. So Richard Morgan makes a living from selling stories about the future of the future, and HarperCollins, whom Teresa works for, amongst other things, exists as a company selling stories about the future of the future. So there's a bit of incentive here to have the future keep going. The future is important. So the question that arose for this panel is, given the current rate of technology we're living in, given the advances that we're making leaping ahead daily, is there still room for speculation about the future? Or is it all, passé? By the time the book is written, it's all just existing, ubiquitous, and no one wants to write about it. Richard.
Yes. I think it's very good news for the genre, to be honest, for a whole host of reasons. One of the things is that there's no doubt we're living in science fictional times, and what that means is that the mainstream, for want of a better descriptor, has been dragged kicking and screaming to have its nose rubbed in science fiction, and that makes things more accessible for us. Obviously, it makes it easier to reach a wider audience. But I think it also makes it easier for us to break out. Any ghetto any ghetto is created because of the tension on both sides of the wall. And, we do carry this enormous burden of, sort of dismissiveness from the mainstream literary current. But at the same time, we sometimes don't make it easy for ourselves, because we do tend to retreat into this kind of siege mentality. And get very upset about the way that the mainstream won't take us seriously and so forth. And I think the fact that we're now living in times that basically fit in a science fiction novel means that both sides have to clean up their act, basically. It will be possible for, people writing SF now to find a large mainstream audience. The chauvinism about science fiction has to start breaking down, because it will be impossible to talk meaningfully about any kind of social or political issue without bringing in the technological component. I was on a panel upstairs and we were talking about mobile phones, the impact that they've had in African nations, where top-down corruption has meant that there is no landline phone network. But mobile phones have come in and just essentially short-circuited that aspect of political corruption. That becomes an issue, that becomes a meaningful piece of cultural knowledge and debate and so forth. And if, mainstream journalists, mainstream creators of literature, for want of a better word, want to deal with that kind of thing, those little bits and pieces that make up human stories, they'll have to come to us. They'll have no choice. But at the same time, we have to go out and proselytise a bit. I mean, we will have to be out there saying, yeah, we've been talking about this shit for years. And we have to modify that so it's not quite as superior. I don't see a problem. I think that we're in rude health, and I think we'll continue to be in rude health. It's nothing but good.
Teresa?
Total agreement. The world is changing so quickly and people aren't keeping up with the changes. And one way they can do for it to become, to understand the change, is to have it in a book, have it in the media. And if they see it more and more, then it becomes the norm. People just do not understand the changes that are happening so quickly. They don't understand how to use the technology. They don't understand how it operates. There's always that fear of what it can do and it's going to overtake. This way, in the science fiction books and just in general mainstream media, this genre is opening up to everyone. And that's just going to continue. I mean, the things that are happening now with biotech, that's the most fascinating object. What's going on there? And that's, to me, that's where I see the future. And, I mean, I still think, there's plenty of room there for spaceships going out to, venture in other worlds. Science fiction is definitely not going away. You can see it stay and get bigger, stronger, faster. We have the technology. Sorry.
Most of the audience missed that.
Does the rapid rate of change make it a lot more difficult to write in the near future? And how do you deal with that if you are to set something in the near future?
It is a problem, yeah. I cheated with the Kovacs books because they're set about 500 years from now. So when I'm proved wrong, I won't be here. And that's always a nice thought. Set market forces 50 years in the future, and it's already looking like I was wrong on a number of counts. It's a risk you take. I love these sweets. But I think the audience, the readership, is remarkably sophisticated, because we go back and we read Gibson, and we don't have a problem with the fact that he was wrong about the mobile phone thing. You know, there aren't any in his future. That doesn't stop us enjoying his future. I think we're able to, if the writing's good, if the story's good, if what's in the book has substance, I think we're well able to make allowances and so forth. Otherwise, no one will be reading any science fiction written before about 1975. If it's good, I mean, I keep going on about Paul Anderson. You know, his Dominic Flandre stories, they have the most ridiculous fantastical concepts in those. They are more fantasy than science fiction, but, you know, they're still great reads. They still stand up.
Is science fiction about the predictions of the technology in the future and how we think society is going to be, or is it more about the people and, you know, how they could be changed because of the technologies in their lives?
Hopefully it's about the latter. I mean, you always hope that it's going to be about people rather than technology, but you do still find there is a sort of a little incubating hothouse of people who actually are so much in love with the technology itself that that's really the focus of what they want to write about. But no, I think we've moved on enormously. I think there's not much of that about anymore.
That was always sort of like science fiction was, I mean, for me, was always using a futuristic setting to say something about the state of the current state of humankind at the moment. It was really more and more so, you know, it's the Martian invasion thing was, you know, the whole communist threat and stuff. So that's, I mean, that's going back to the human element. So setting it in a future thing, it is more saying about the state of what humankind is at the moment as well.
Well, I think this is one of the things where, when I said the barriers are going to start to come down, this is one of the areas where, you know, we're going to have to go out and proselytise. I was on this radio show, I was jet lagged, so I don't remember when it was, but shortly after I arrived in Australia, and
ABC Book Show Monday morning.
Yeah, and I remember that I was sort of saying, well, you know, the issue here is that science fiction is never really about the future, it's about now. You know, and William Gibson said, you know, I wasn't writing about the future, I was writing about our current predicament, using the future and so forth. But the woman who was running the book show was clearly unaware of this. I mean, you know, for all of us in this room, it is a truism. It's so obvious it doesn't need stating. But for most mainstream readers, that's still something they haven't actually taken on board. So this is one of the, you know, if you want to help a literati, you know, that's what you do. That's one of the things you can do for them. You can say, well, science fiction is not about the future. It's about now. Look at it in those terms. But yeah, it's you know, that's exactly one of the things that has to go. Yeah.
Most of the quite near future science fiction tends to be quite dystopian. The only thing that I can really think of that's not is some Cory Doctorow Eastern Standard Tribe. Which is really more comedy than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Is there very much being written that is more positive about the near future, or what's the balance? Who's writing what?
Well, I really tried with Black Man. I really tried. I had this interesting experience at Worldcon in Glasgow 2005 when we had a panel on dystopias. And so we were all there going on about being gritty and real and so forth. And this East German woman, I didn't know at the time that she was East German, but we later on found this out. She stood up and she berated us all. And she said, you have a duty to the people to write a future that we would want to live in. You know, if you don't, you create the futures for us in our imagination. If you don't write the future that we would like to live in, where can we take our hope from? And I thought that was fascinating, as if she'd grown up in a culture that, obviously under the communist regime, where writers had a responsibility, you know, which is, again, news to me. and B, a responsibility to you know, to be socially, what's the word, optimistic, you know, to say that, you know, life will get better, problems will be solved. And it really gave me pause for thought, and I was sort of gently tried to explain to her, you know, why you'd write a dystopia, you know, that it's not, if you think that's great, it's that you're trying to make a point about not going in the wrong direction, etc., etc. But anyway, she was a fascinating woman to talk to. And so when it came to write Black Man, I really, really tried. I thought, this is not going to be a dystopia. Okay, we'll make this, you know, this could be quite a nice future to live in some ways. And then, and I made it as even-handed as I possibly could. But the problem is that we're already living in a dystopia. And, you know, I don't think the futures that I've written have actually been sort of largely more unpleasant than the current reality. And I think that's when you say most near future fiction seems to be dystopian, I think that's because what it's really doing is it's taking on the mantle of contemporary reality, which is also pretty dystopian. And in that sense, you know, I mean, it's like you know, an Ian Rankin crime novel is dystopian, you know, because it looks at the underbelly of Edinburgh in the early 2000s, you know. And I think we're up against this thing of, you know, in a sense, what is utopian fiction? I mean, there are a few feminist writers. Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time will be one, I think. Although there's a couple of nasty, gritty bits to that, too. What was the other one I was thinking of? Herland, maybe, but that's pretty ancient. But, I mean, there are a few writers who've genuinely attempted to envisage a utopia, but mostly it doesn't work. You know, because a utopia is a place where nothing goes wrong, so you don't really...
I mean, you do get utopias where things do go wrong, for example, Dispossessed.
But that's not a utopia. I mean, that's why it's a brilliant novel, is because it's saying, you think that this will be a wonderful society, but if you look closely, here are the cracks. And what's fascinating about the anarchist society in that book is not how it works, but how it doesn't work. You know, the way it... Because you're all through the book, you're thinking, why has he come here? Why has he left? You know, and the book... As the same time, the book exposes the flaws in the home world and in the sort of the standardised autocratic ways of doing things, it also pulls apart the anarchist vision and says there are problems here too. So I'm really hard pressed to think of, because yeah, a utopian story would be, you know, I got up and went to work and had a really lovely day. The end.
I skipped a work bit. I got up and had a really lovely day.
Positivity about the whole thing. I mean, I recently read Dreaming Again, which is the sequel to the Dreaming Down Under stories that were written, anthology that was written 10 years ago. And the first one, most of the stories are fairly positive. And then you go through and read the second one, which is, you know, a gap of 10 years. We've had 9/11. We've had all this stuff happen, and it's just so much more depressing.
That was a reflection.
Can you quantify what the shift was?
Well,
life sucks.
No. I mean, what the differences were between the first collection and the second.
They're both probably Teresa would know more about the anthologies than I do, but the first one. I mean, they're both drawn from Australian writers, but there was a lot. There was a larger proportion of the stories in the second one had a dystopian element, very often very dark, gritty futures with very pronounced, I guess, abuse of some classes or genders. And it was just, seemed to be the predominant colour of the anthology, with the previous anthology there'd been a lot more, I guess, sort of playing with ideas, and maybe there's also a lot more horror in the second anthology.
My personal opinion on that with a lot of writers was, and we were all living through it, and again it's my own personal opinion, we were living through the Bush era, where we were living in a world where terrorism, life, just everything just seemed to be oppressed. And I just think that was a reflection of the time that we were living in.
Also, when the first one was released, it was the late 90s, we're in the dot-com boom, the economy was booming.
Yes.
Things were a lot rosier.
Things were a lot rosier.
It was the tail end of the Clinton years.
I think... There's a really good movie which I think is just coming to Australia now. It's been out for a while in the UK, called The Whackness. You ever heard of this? It's got Ben King.
It has been out a while, hasn't it?
Oh, right. Okay. Well, if you haven't seen it, you should really see it. It's a brilliant movie. Ben Kingsley's in it. But a guy graduating from school in New York. He's also a part-time drug dealer. And Ben Kingsley is a washed-up psychology teacher and psychiatrist. And they exchange. He supplies drugs to Ben Kingsley in return for counselling. It's a really fun movie. But one of the things that was very striking about it was how unbelievably innocent the 90s seem, looking back. I think, yeah, you know, the Berlin Wall had gone down, fall of communism, there was a real sense of positivism in the world. You know, perhaps from a global perspective, completely unjustified, because, you know, for 8/10 of the world's population, not much had changed, I think. But certainly in the developed world, there was a real sense of, now we're finally getting somewhere. And yeah, of course, 9/11 and what followed just completely flipped that
about. We got past the recession of the 80s and past that whole greedy group mentality, and it was like, oh yeah, we've got over that, we've grown up a bit.
Yeah.
We can go forward and the universe comes down and we do that.
I think in a sense that was what was so sort of stunning about the Bush years was what an enormous step back it seemed to be. You know, it wasn't, because we'd seen it with Reagan before, but the whole thought, as you say, we seem to have been through a learning process. And it's like, no, let's go back and do it this way. That maybe that's the explanation, I don't know.
So, did you have a question? Did you have a question earlier?
Oh, earlier. Okay, cool.
That's fine.
Well, I did have more comment, again, relevant to something earlier, when you were saying about technology changing. Charlie Cross's latest book, whose name escapes me, the one about the robbery in the online game.
Jennifer Morgue?
No. Holding State.
You've stolen one of my lines.
When he, if you read his blog while he was doing the final draft, he was sort of, you go and read it in the morning and says, right, okay, pages 66 to 75, they're obsolete now. Someone's done it. And it was just like, as he's editing it, it was coming out of date before it had even been published. So, even though he said it 20, 30 years in the future.
There's no doubt about it. So we have to run to keep up. And I say that, well, I'm writing fantasy now, so.
Well, I work in IT, so I know all about running to keep up.
Yeah, right.
I thought you were going to say in fantasy. You want what when?
Yes.
So, Teresa, where do you see things going in the sci-fi world in the next 5 to 10 years? Put the guests on the spot.
They've got people writing.
Do you want a little bit of thinking time?
I can
plug this with some random noise. I was just thinking, in a very interesting book, Jeff Ryman's Air. Has anyone read that? That's very good, I recommend that. I think that Air is the shape of what science fiction might turn into in the future. Because Air is a book that would have, you know, it, with all justification, could have gone onto the Booker Prize list. It really should have been shortlisted. Don't say it should have won, but it should have been shortlisted. And it's basically set in this imagined country that is somewhere east of Turkey and west of China, but that's pretty much all you can work out. He's borrowed from Turkic and Chinese culture to create the culture of this place. And it's a little village in the middle of nowhere. So it feels a bit Tibetan as well. And it's the last place in the world to go online. The only place that still doesn't have internet. And then this new thing comes along called Air, which is basically like direct-to-head internet. And it goes catastrophically wrong. But it's the story of this one woman who lives in the village. She's the village seamstress, and she's a bit of a schemer. She's a sort of got this peasant cunning, which enables her to keep on top of all the political games in the village. And it's weird because the technology, the technology, the way he doesn't really bother to describe how it works. In fact, there's a brilliant bit where one of the characters tries to explain it, but this woman has no education. She left school at, 8 or something. And he just gives up. And he goes, oh, it's because there are 11 dimensions or something. And just it's left. But what I thought was interesting was that it's a very human story. The technology almost takes on a kind of magic realism. It's what the technology does, and especially the impact that it has in a number of different ways, it's almost like the stuff you find in Marquez. These sort of, they seem ludicrously impossible events, but the technology sort of facilitates it. And so what you've got really, I would say, is a future magic realist novel. That might be where we can go with this. Is that you end up writing something that seems very contemporary and hard-edged, but just has that really strange flavour around the technology. I was saying how quantum mechanics, just if you tried to sell that as a concept in a book, no one would buy it. It's just, that's rubbish, it's going to be ridiculous. Quantum mechanics is a kind of magic realism, and if you start to import those kind of things into your fiction, you'll be maybe a much more real kind of novel. With these really, really outre semi-technological concepts floating around. But certainly, as I say, Jeff Ryman's Air, the finest piece of science fiction writing I've read in a very long time. Very strange novel.
I see science fiction becoming more mainstream. I really see the numbers moving up in the quantities that are sold and the acceptance of reading of science fiction. I think there'll be more off-world stories. I mean, these are personal opinions, but the new technology that is coming out, you know, the things that you can now do with fungus that they're playing with, I just think there's going to be far more looking in so that we can go further out there. And I don't know who's going to be the author that will break that out, but I can definitely see there being sort of going back to sort of like the old science fiction in the 1950s, that more adventure, the more adventure style off-world. And I just see that becoming sort of a big trend. But again, it's my own personal opinion.
A lot of space opera then, you think?
But a bit more, with a bit more technology. But the technology is going to be in the background. It's not going to be the mainstream, the main part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
People will just accept it. But I just believe there'll be more people reading it. That's the big thing. That's my own. I've had that gut feeling for the last couple of years, and it seems to be growing.
I was going to ask with that, do you view that as more socially motivated because we're reaching a sort of a dark period and going for escapist entertainment, or do you see it as a way of around the, well, if we set it this far advanced, we can deal with the technological aspects of it?
Well, yes, in some parts, but I see it also because the things off-world are becoming a reality. You know, with all the probes, the satellites, we're now looking at Mars. You know, you're looking at going back to the moon, you're looking at going back to, you're going to Mars. That's becoming a reality. So there's going to be more interest. You know, the kids who are growing up are actually going to be starting to be excited again by about outer space.
Well, we now have the reality of space tourism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you've got Google Space.
Like few, but...
Yeah, so that's where I see it.
It's about stories going to places where they haven't been. If you're listening the other day, you're in the back of a globe with a book cover, like, you know. They're just so many variations of themes. I think there are, in terms of more readership for science fiction novels, they're better stories. They're better written, a lot of them, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, how many crime books can you done in the kitchen by
just this? Yeah, with the candlestick and
yeah.
The white room. The jacketing on fantasy and science fiction is they're trying to make it more mainstream. So it appeals to a broader market rather than having, a dragon on the front.
Well, maybe we can be like Harry Potter. You can have like a genre cover, and then and you can have the
I'm not embarrassed to read.
Yes, exactly.
That's what the A and B formats for.
That is already happening, really.
Yes.
Well, the Terry Pratchett stuff has been re-released. The new covers are all very plain.
Yes.
Huge re-editions.
Yes, they are. We do quite a few. Somebody done.
You have a future that you try to create. For the real world. Elizabeth Moon writes in her books as though renewable sustainable energy is a given. And by doing this, she hopes that she has projected this image where people see it as a future that is realistic and therefore will work towards that future. Have you a mission like that?
That's very socially responsible of Elizabeth.
That's a very diplomatic answer.
God, I wish I was like that. It's very much according to what you're writing. In a sense, it would be like me writing the fantasy novel with a sort of, and remember, kids, don't play with sharp objects without a supervising adult. I wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, if I thought that sustainable technology was an interesting facet of the mosaic, then yeah, I'd go for it, obviously. But since I tend to be focused on the bad things that we do and the underbelly, it's unlikely that I saw a fascinating documentary about a week before I came away called Who Killed the Electric Car? Anyone see that?
Yeah.
And it's essentially the story of how General Motors point blank refused to allow an electric car to develop. They were forced to build it by the state of California. The state of California basically said, you want to sell cars in our state, you've got to build a working electric car. So they did it. It was very successful for a limited purpose. It was good for commuting, basically. They wouldn't sell it, they only leased it. And when it looked like it was really going to take off, they cancelled all the leases and took them back. And then they sued the state of California for making them make the electric car. And they had people, they interviewed the people who'd driven these, they had the people who'd leased them, begging to be allowed to keep, said, look, I'll buy it, I'll pay off whatever the remainder on the lease is, I will buy it from you. And General Motors saying, if you attempt to buy this vehicle, you will be sued. Unfortunately, I think when you've got a mentality like that entrenched, where a major corporation will literally trash so much positive potential, for the most venal of reasons. And even it's not even about money. It, to me, from what I could get out of that documentary, more than anything, it was about sheer spite. It was because they were so pissed off that the fucking commie, pinko, socialist, Californian assholes had forced them to build this thing. By God, they were going to make it fail. They would make these people pay. When you're aware of those strands within sort of human behaviour, it's very hard to do an Elizabeth Moon, for me. But she is female, and I think women are just so much better at sort of spotting the potential positive of any given situation. Yes, that's my line. I mean, that's where I come in. I come in with waving the flag and saying, look at this shit, isn't this awful? Don't do this.
I've got a bit more of a positive spin on that now. Okay. Because of the economic downturn, the car companies would never have contemplated the electric car. Mm-hmm. As you're right, they shredded the things. But now,
they're tripping over their feet
because they have to embrace green technology. Green technology is the way of the future, and green technology is where the money is. I remember years ago, a religious company comes to me and I knock on the door, hello, watchtower, blah, blah, blah. And they said to me, greed is going to destroy the world. And I went, it's going to save it. And I was horrified. And I went, there's to a point where we're going to destroy the planet, and then they're not going to be able to make more money. So they'll have to change their technology to make money, and they'll charge us a fortune for it, and then it will hit a status quo, and the price will come down, and we'll all have to embrace green technology, and it will be the norm.
And they said, yep, thank you very much, we'll find next door.
They backed away slowly. Yeah, they didn't. And I mean, I said it 20 years ago, and I still, in my heart of heart now with what's happened in the world, believe it.
Well, I think more accurately would be to say greed is such a dynamic, a major dynamic in human beings,
yes,
that you will have to harness it before,
yes,
you can achieve anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's a simplification of how I'm saying it, but it will save us all.
But sorry, did I answer your question?
Just to address what you just said, the sad part for me is that economic downturns and petrol dollars and the price of petrol are related. So when the economy is bad, petrol is cheap, which means that currently all the prices that everybody bought when the times were good are currently winding up in dump heaps in America. And everybody's going back to buy hummus because petrol is cheap and more hummus again.
Well, and because the American government gave a $100,000 tax break to anybody who bought one, apparently.
It breaks my heart. Yeah. So you go at the one time they could have, and then
they're going to end up with egg on their face about the end of this year, because petrol's just going to go right back to where it was and suck in.
And those car companies have had all those billions of dollars given to them, and they haven't produced an answer. They can only keep going for so many months. They've got to change the model that they're using.
Just a really interesting thing on that with the cars. Like, I was reading this thing the other month about why cars were first invented, and you know the nature of solutions in relation to problems in the world. And like, does anyone actually know why cars were first invented?
So teenage boys could go out with teenage girls.
No, they were probably in the 1920s, and they were, what was the name of the cars? And they were the Model T.
Model T's.
And the reason they were invented was actually because of all the horses in New York.
Oh, yeah, the manure.
And all the manure they were producing in the street was making a lot of methane and people getting sick. So cars were initially invented to protect the pollution. Literally. There were newspaper headlines, you know, horseless carriage will kill air pollution.
It worked for a while, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, but
that
was thinking it was probably still the same problem.
In 1990s or so, it was mostly it's just that as the cities were getting bigger, they were too big to go
horses.
Yeah. Horses can only go so far in a day. The cities were already getting bigger than that. You needed parts of transport. There was a problem. They solved it.
Also, I remember reading an interesting article where they said that it has to do with the order things were invented in, because they said if the bicycle had been invented after the car, then it would have been hailed as this fantastic liberating thing. Look, it's only two wheels, it's really light, you can carry it, it's so much better than a car, that they, you know, they really would have pushed it, whereas since it already existed, it was the car that they pushed. I'm not sure how much scientific truth there is, but it's a nice idea.
I think it's worth noting while we talk about transport that, of course, the cars didn't take over until that scenario from Roger Rabbit happened. They bought up the trolley companies.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the transport solution was already there, the trolley car.
And that's kind of why General Motors in California have that whole angst, hatred, because GM bought.
They were the ones who killed it, yeah.
Three cities for destroying the transport system.
No, this is very true.
I'm a physicist, and one of the things I've noticed is that over the last few decades, there's been less and less fiction focusing on fundamental physics and new laws of fundamental physics. It's all on the applications of those laws. It's probably because fundamental physics is an exponential process. Every step is exponentially harder to get than the next step. So there really hasn't been much progress in actual fundamental physics since the 70s, most likely. I'm just wondering what the next advance in fundamental physics is going to do to the fiction, whether it's going to bring back the whole extra dimension, parallel dimension, universe travel that was all the vogue in the
80s. Well, can I ask you a question? Where are we with the 11-dimensional thing? Because
all of the string theory, 11-dimensional stuff, is all theories about what might be true.
But have they not...
The experiments to determine which one's right are too hard. The energies are too high.
All right, have they not decided that they were wrong about it now?
They haven't decided they're wrong. All of it's possible, and they're coming up with more and more plausible alternatives. But then there's the brain theory, sort of string theory, there's all these different variants of it. Many of them involve extra dimensions, but they can't work out which of 100 competing theories are actually right until they can test it.
Will the collider solve any of these problems?
It'll be one of those next exponential steps. Well, the application is about a decade away.
Well, I love this. Have you read Jana Levin's book, How the Universe Got Its Spots? That's brilliant. That's superb. So, I'm going to be really reductionist and genetic about this as well. I mean, it's a brilliant female take on particle physics and cosmology. This is what she does for a living. And the book is part of it is about what shape the universe is, and the other half of it is about how she's having a hard time explaining to her mum what she does for a living. And I just think it's lovely, because it basically her entire thing is, look, people go mad doing what I do for a living. They actually, these very, very theoretical physicists and cosmologists, lots of them go insane and end up in asylums, or they kill themselves or stuff like that. And she's clearly quite worried about this. And so she's desperately attempting to sort of drag this back to a more human perspective for her own sanity as much as anything else. And so it's a brilliantly explained, it's the one of the few books I've ever read where I didn't actually have to strain to understand the concept. Michio Kaku, who I read a lot of, who I also think is brilliant, but he really loses me sometimes. I'm left going, slow down. But anyway, How the Universe Got Its Spots. And apparently we are within a very short space of time of being able to know what shape the universe is, because we just need a big enough telescope to look at the shape of the dust in the sky. And she's saying, if the dust looks like this, then the universe is round. If it's like this, it's got a teapot handle on one side of it. that's the point at which I start, when I say no one will buy into this stuff as if you wrote it as fiction. But I really recommend it because it's a fantastic book. And again, it had this whole, the sense that these ultimate answers are really not that far away, that we're actually going to get them, possibly in our lifetimes. How the Universe Got Its Spots, by Jana Levin. She then wrote a novel, I can't remember what it's called, but it's not very good.
Just remember that was recorded as well. we've talked about, we have a problem, manure, transport, whatever, technology is deployed, it's the new future. To what degree do you exploit that? Do you look at the problems, look at then what technology might be deployed and what problems that will cause to set your work in? Or is it more just a that's just what you pick at the time and then you explore as you go?
I'm not sure. To be honest with you, I tend to start with two guys in a room. I mean, I really, almost everything I've ever written has started off with a couple of people having a conversation somewhere, usually somewhere seedy. And it all kind of gets, it's like a dung beetle. It kind of gets rolled into form from that. And what tends to happen is that those kind of questions crop up as I'm going along. Because it's like, in the conversation, one of the guys will need the toilet. So how's that being handled? All that stuff for me, it comes under the heading of incidentals, which means I really don't give it an awful lot of thought until I actually have to deal with it in the narrative. Which means it very often is just strapped together out of whatever I can come up with at the time. And then you go back later on and try and make it work.
Does it ever surprise you when you just come up with an incidental and suddenly go, wow, there's a lot more in that than I thought?
Yes. It always surprises me, in fact. Okay, wow, that's really interesting. How do you come up with that? But I think, in a sense, there's something nice to doing it blind like that, because I think I'm not mystical about this, but I do think your brain works at a series of subconscious levels much harder than it does at a conscious level. And I think a lot of the stuff that I've come up with that I like in my books has really been my subconscious flailing around to get me out of trouble. And interestingly, I'm a climber in my spare time, and was watching an interview with a free climber. They're the completely insane guys who do it without ropes or anything. Are there any of those here? Well, they do have quite short life expectancy. But this guy was explaining how, he said, you'll sometimes climb yourself into a position where you really don't know how to get out of it. And you don't have the option that I have when I'm climbing. You go, okay, I'm going to have a rest now. So he said, you find yourself in this position, you have no clue, and, you can only hold on for a certain amount of time. And he said, and then something will click in your head. And he said, it's really strange, it's hard to describe what happens. But he said, and you will then find you have climbed out of that situation. He said, you will wake up 15 seconds later, having done what needs to be done. And I sometimes think that there's a variant on that with my writing, that there is a subconscious caretaker rushing around going, oh, Christ, now where are we? Quick, some reason to explain why that guy disappeared. And this stuff, I'd be sunk without that. I really would. And most of the rationale comes from after the event. I hope I'm not giving away trade secrets here. but no, I mean, I sometimes feel like a bit of a fraud, because it is a barely conscious process, which I don't understand well myself, and I hesitate to tinker with in case it stops working.
Teresa, you mentioned earlier the biotech side, and Richard obviously done some genetic engineering type work. Well,
not in itself, my garage.
Tinkering in the garage, yes. I hear that's illegal in Britain now.
Yeah, they spoil all the fun.
Where do you think the bio engineering and genetic engineering may go?
Anywhere and everywhere. I mean, one of the biggest things I really want someone to invent is a little implant in here, cover all this knowledge, and I have trouble retrieving it. am accessing that, and I just love to have.
You want Google in your brain.
Yeah, basically just file it, search it, find it, and be able to say it all in explicit.
Read Jeff Ryman's Air, and you'll change your mind about that.
But I don't see there being anywhere where it can't go. I mean, also, you know, the work with the collider, what that's going to open up. There's so much in there that we just don't know, and there's going to be so many stories. I mean, every time you pick up new scientists and read what's happening, it's just right there in front of you, and if I had the imagination, I just believe the writers who are around now can just take anything anywhere. We can go smaller, and we can, yeah, and things are getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, but yeah, it allows us to travel anywhere.
I think we're... I think one of the things that I've found kind of wearying about the last 10 years in genre fiction has been vampires, because I'm really sick of them. And yeah, they
twinkle.
Don't they sell?
Very briefly, when you put
them
in the sun.
But we do seem to have really overused our stock of monsters. And one of the things about biotech, of course, is that we are going to have a whole new crop of monsters, for want of a better word, because this technology really is just around the corner. And if you want another recommendation for a non-fiction book, you're out of luck, because I can't remember the title. a book about, it's called something like Rebuilding Humans. It's an American writer. He's a little bit optimistic for my liking. He's way too happy about it all. But he's essentially saying that, you know, we are very, very close to a situation where you'll be able to build in genetic change for your children. But it will be reversible genetic change. So apparently what they've come up with is they can actually build now an artificial chromosome. So it'll be tacked onto the 13 that you've already got. And it's just a framework, and into that, and this is the bit they can't do yet, into that you will be able to plug all sorts of gene variations, which will then interact with what's on the rest of the chromosomes in which, you know, a predictable way. But the great thing about it will be that you will actually be able to, there'll be chemical switches for turning this stuff on and off. Because the guy who wrote the book, he said, you know, if I were to go to my daughter, who's just about to go off to grad school, and offer to give her my Apple II, to write her essays on. She's just going, Dad, what is this? He's saying in a similar way, you know, the genetic modifications that we build into ourselves, you know, in a couple of generations it may turn out we don't want them because the diseases they were for have been eradicated, or there's something that's much cooler or whatever. So he's presupposing a coming age in which you'll be able to load up a whole stack of different genetic possibilities. And if your children don't want them for whatever reason, I mean, he said also for religious reasons, if people sort of change their ethical ideas and decide they don't want this extra whatever it is, that you'll be able to, with a chemical switch, you'll be able to basically invalidate it again. Once that's possible, you are basically looking at divergence in what human beings are. Not at a physical level so much, although that will come as well. I think that's the easy stuff. That's the sort of Sci-Fi Channel makeup department stuff. But just at a psychological level. You know, that you will be able to make people sociopathic. That came to mind because that's the kind of stuff I write. Or very, very smart. Or very sensitive. You know, enormous empathic range, maybe. Stuff like this. These are all going to be very, very feasible things to do in the future. And the near future, I think we'll live to see this. And the potential for new kinds of monsters is absolutely massive. It's, you know, it's a whole new field opening up. And of course, we're all scared of difference. So, whoa. there's a field to be ploughed there.
That sort of concept has been sort of explored. There's a movie called Tim Robbins' movie called Code 46, where basically they alter you. They actually have viruses which go in and can give you extra abilities. In the movie, they only cover the one where they give you a great empathic ability, which basically turns them into a mind reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now there's also Peter Watts' novel Blind Sight. Has anyone read that? That's purely brilliant novel. It can be downloaded for free. He put it into Creative Commons and it's downloadable. But I feel bad about telling you that because I don't really buy that shit about Creative Commons. Because, you know, everyone says, no, but, you know, book sales go up. And maybe that's true, but you know what? I downloaded it for free and read it and thought it was one of the best science fiction novels I've ever read and made a note to buy it and haven't.
But you've just told a full audience about it.
Yeah, we'll do the same thing, yeah.
One person buys it.
But no, I mean, it's a very, very good novel, and you get it, just go to his website, you can download it for free, and then, you know, please go out and buy it. And I will do it. But that's brilliant. And he has, again, there's one modified guy who's got that massive empathic range. He also has vampires, odd, interestingly enough, but they are the best vampires I've ever seen, because he has a completely watertight, totally physical, material explanation for what they are and where they're from. And it totally works. And they're completely terrifying. I mean, they're much more scary than anything you'll see in Twilight.
So, in terms of what's coming up, we've talked about genetic engineering, biotech. We touched briefly on space colonization and whatnot. What else is still hot or is still coming out? We look at AI's cyborg side. Is that still happening, or is that passé now? No,
very much. I mean, you know, sort of cochlear implants, and they're going to. I understand the visual stuff for eye implants is on its way. That's going to be good. Drugs. There's a link on my website to a thing called cocaine.org, and that in turn is linked to an enormous bunch of other stuff. But it's, I don't know who these guys are who put the website up. They're completely strange. But there's all this stuff about future drugs, and basically saying, you know, all this stuff that we use as drugs now, this is so primitive. He said, you know, once we start tailoring things so that you get all of the benefits of morphine or cocaine, but none of the downsides. He said, once that starts, they're anticipating a future in which humans will look back at a period in which we did not exist, in a state of bliss for large portions of our lives, and will be horrified by the brutality of it.
There's been a lot of places that have been wanting to, a lot of pharmaceutical companies have been wanting to do stuff like that along with, because there's obviously a phenomenal amount of money in it, but there's a phenomenal amount of political backlash to trying it, because they're like, you're making drugs for pleasure purposes, that's illegal, you're not allowed to do that, you're only allowed to make
it's
drugs.
It's illegal in the first world.
Yes, but that's why these companies exist, that's why they'll be developing them. All that sort of money is made. But I mean, this is coming from someone who's well and truly chemically dependent on various things. It would make these huge differences to the mental health industry at the very least, to have stuff around that could make people, that could switch things on, make them happy, even if it is like drunk enough happy, and turn off all this other stuff about the side effects. But the people who want to do this stuff keep getting knocked off by political, moral, ethical boards.
Well, I think there's a genuine, and it's intensely puritanical, and it's very class based as well. And you can go right back to gin in Britain in the 1700s, where there was this move to outlaw gin. And what was at the base of, there was a lot of moral outcry, but what really was at the base of this was they could not get people to work. They were terrified that their workforce, the working class, would not go to work. Their factories would be empty. Their fields would not be tilled. And that was what drove the whole thing of regulation and trying to make it illegal. And similarly, most of the anti-drug legislation in the United States over the last century has been driven by very, very sectional political and economic interests. No question about it. And I don't know what it'll take to explode that, actually.
America's a very funny case with that, because they're the most vehemently anti-drugs, yet they're also the biggest drug market. And quite often the same people.
Did anyone ever read Bloom County? I don't
yes.
know.
Yes.
You remember the hair tonic interdiction agency?
Yes.
That was just outstanding. If you haven't read Bloom County, there's a... Well, I can't explain it, it's too complicated, but basically the characters invent this substance by accident, which cat sweat.
Yes,
hair
made from cat sweat.
Made from cat sweat. And it basically regrows, it solves male pattern baldness. So it's very successful, and then it's made illegal because people who take it start to make noises like cats coughing up hairballs. So as a result of this minor social disadvantage, it's made illegal. And suddenly the profits of this our little pal's company just soar through the roof. Then there's the Scalptonic Interdiction Agency get in on the act, and they managed to interdict 0.37% of the traffic. And so they go, price raise, 0.37%. It's the superb piece of political, it's some of the best political critique I've ever seen. But yeah, I mean, it's a losing game, and I even heard quite a senior political commentator saying a few months back, saying, you know, we are coming up on 100 years since the Harrison Narcotics Act. It's 100 years war. When you haven't won in 100 years war, it's time to sit down and talk terms.
Did you see that Delpho drama? It wasn't released here. It hasn't been shown on television here. Somebody gave me a copy to watch, and it's called If. And it was all about set in 2015 and drugs were legal. It was a doco drama.
No,
they were from two sides. It's fascinating because basically drugs became legal. And you had the doco drama going on because a bad batch got in and the police were trying to detect who had made these, had it been a chemical company that had released it accidentally, what was going on, a few people were dying. But the whole thing was, it was a health issue. And it was just part of society, and it was all set up. And then in between it, you had police officers talking about drugs, what was happening now, and where they believe the future is going. And you had religious leaders. And every time you heard someone, you'd go, wow, that's a really good point, yeah, drugs should be legal. And then somebody else would speak, and they were speaking so passionately about all the social problems. You'd go, shit, yeah, you're right, there's problems there, it shouldn't be legal. And then the next person, and it was one of the most fat, because there was even balance all the way through. And you couldn't make a decision either way, because personally I believe it should be a health issue.
I think, to be honest, is there anybody in this room, I mean, let's not be, is there anyone in this room who doesn't believe it should be a health issue? Yeah, that's the thing, you know. And I am hearing it literally from senior policemen in the UK right up to the British ambassador to Afghanistan. You know, who is saying, when they're saying, well, what do we do about the heroin problem? You know, and he's saying, fucking legalise it. Everyone's going to grow this crop anyway.
Well,
yeah.
We're already making money off
coffee fields in the world are here in Australia. They're in Tasmania.
They're legal, are they?
Legal.
Yes.
It's medical.
Oh, more medical morphine, right, yeah. Yeah, yeah, well, and we've actually got a global morphine shortage, apparently, at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're still setting fire to the fields in Afghanistan. Yeah.
That's the one loophole in creating these drugs, creating them with the intention of them being these drugs. Gets you in trouble, but with some things, and Grafflin is a terrible drug as an example, but with speed, the epidurin, pseudoepidurin, they create epidurin, pseudoepidurin, people figure out, hey, we can make this all stuff for it, and they're like, well, that's legal, and the drug company's like, well, sod it, we'll just export this epidurin to these other countries that'll make
it's not illegal,
and they can't do anything about it. They were selling off tons and tons of this stuff that's made into speed, and
now pseudoephedrine don't work as well.
but the other thing also, I think, is that there's an enormous short-sightedness here on the part of you know, political pundits in the Western world, because what the Western world is good for is basically taking something relatively raw from the developing world and selling them it back in a much better form. So, you know, anyone can make cocaine. You know, you can cook that stuff up in a little shack in the jungle in Colombia, and if the Americans would just piss off back home, that's what the Colombians will be doing. But the whole edge for the Western world will be if it's pharmaceutical companies go, well, cocaine, yeah, but that does tend to make your nose fall out. So what about this? You know, and developing these drugs that, as I said, don't carry the negative side effects.
There is a series that have been developed, all the
right, yeah.
There's research chemical drugs that have been developed purely for the effects they produce, and they've been tested methylated, well, semi-medically, you know, people taken various plants and written a diary of experiences. Fecal is the book, phenylamines I've known and loved, is the acronym.
Yeah.
And there's also a TCO, which is for the tryptamines. Alexander Shulgin is a doctor, a research chemist in America, producing these at the moment.
Right.
And they're synthesized in various forms of all sorts of drugs, which are much cleaner and much safer. And
there's no medical reason for any of those either.
No, they're purely for recreational and experiential.
Yeah, well, as far as I understand it, there's literally no medical reason not to sell licensed ecstasy.
There's one, pure MDMA depletes serotonin levels and create long-term depression. That's really
exciting. It's long-term, though.
I think in terms of drugs, what we need is a context shift. Like, while we believe we've got a drug problem, we're never going to be able to do anything because we've got a problem with drugs. What we need is actually
drugs as a health issue or as even just as a, you know, a solution.
Well, I think I think the interesting thing for me is that people continually talk about a drug problem, but if you look at it, no country in the world has a drug problem. It has a poverty problem, because rich people don't have a problem with drugs. They really don't. You know, they buy them. They buy good quality. Occasionally, they have to check into some rehab. But fundamentally, they clean their own house. It's the poor people who fuck up.
It's also a Western civilization. There's an interesting breaking over the head where a guy goes around to all sort of non-Western civilizations and studies that, you know, they all had some kind of form of drug taking that was not looked at negatively upon by the group or whatever,
and
so it is essentially a Western problem.
Mm. Well, it's an American problem. I was rereading some Ian Fleming not long ago, and Goldfinger, which begins with Bond being sent to Mexico to blow up a drugs factory, and it basically critiques the whole change in the 50s from when heroin was just basically prescribed by your doctor. Yeah. So if you were an addict, you went to your doctor, you got a maintaining dose, which was clean, and that was the problem solved, and there were about 5,000 addicts in the whole country. And, you know, it was the American legislation that basically destroyed that model.
We're just about out of time, so I want one last question. I think Stephen's been waiting for ages.
On the drug issue, firstly, The Economist recently came out and said, don't just legalise the whole thing.
Right.
The other issue is that what is likely to happen for the legalisation of the drugs is what's happened with artificial growth hormone, what's happened with breast implant, etc. Suddenly, the medical lobby will be persuaded, okay, being unhappy is now a disease. The only way we can make money out of this pharmaceutical is if we create a disease that will have to take this drug.
Obviously, you have met your
depressive. I have.
But you know, we view that. Getting briefly back to science fiction here, we kind of view that as you know, strange, verging on scary. But the interesting thing is, it's not. I remember seeing a collection of Herb Ritt's photos of Africa, and a number of pages were photos of Africans' feet, and it was just basically looking at the feet of these guys, these tribesmen. They're destroyed. I mean, you know, they're missing a toe or two. They've got smashed in nails. There's just unbelievable amount of damage that you take from not having shoes. Mm-hmm. We all take shoes for granted now. You know, no one's saying, you know, scary thing, you know, your feet will never hurt. You know, so it's, I think the science fiction perspective is to step forward at that time and go, yeah, we will, there'll be a time when we think, yeah, emotional pain will just be like, why would you put yourself through that?
And on that note, I think we're going to wrap up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.